George, your experience in Singapore, Malaya, as was Malaysia, as is, spanned a period of nearly 20 years from post-war reconstruction right through up to beyond independence, through the Malayan troubles and through riots in Singapore and a lot of other dramatic changes. What stands out, looking back at that period as a whole, what stands out in your memory? I'd say, let's take individuals first, we'll take incidents later. Mm. Individuals, mm. colorful, prominent, interesting, rogues, heroes.
Yes, well, that's rather a tall order because naturally over that period of time I met a great number of people. And of course as one gets older, one's memory perhaps fades somewhat. But I do recall one or two things which might be of interest to discuss. For example, when I was in Borneo, I met, this was in 49, I met some very strange characters there. One of them I remember in particular was an Englishman who ran a tobacco estate in the east side of British North Borneo at a place called Darvel, which I believe is the name of a place in Ayrshire, and was also the name of one of our ships that went around the coast. And this gentleman, when I went to visit his tobacco estate as part of my sort of trip round the coast, he had about half a dozen young European men who were his assistants. And this place was run rather like a military camp. When the manager was showing me round, he was wanted me to look at a particular section of the tobacco that was all laid out in rows, and he shouted out rather like a sergeant major for somebody called, shall we say, Smithers. And Smithers ran up at a tremendous pace and landed about 3 feet away from us at attention, bringing his feet smartly together, and was then told to lift up a tobacco leaf nearby to show it to me, because it was quite obviously quite beneath the dignity of the manager to do so. And he stood to attention the whole time he was being spoken to by his manager and kept referring to him very obsequiously. And I learned later on that the whole camp was run on these lines, and that the manager, who was married, had this habit of sitting up drinking till 3 or 4 in the morning and insisting that all his assistants stayed with him and drank with him, drink for drink. And yet, these lads were expected to be up again at 6 in the morning, and the manager was up himself to make sure that they were. So they had a pretty rough existence all around. I don't know quite how they put up with it. I think they had a fairly large turnover of people, because it was right in the jungle and there were no other recreations for these people, whatever. So that was one that I can think of. Another time in Sandakan, one of the Jardine Matheson ships, Indochina Steam Navigation, came down, as they frequently did, to pick up logs and timber. And the passengers that came off that included a young Scot who was an ex-AB from the Royal Navy, who had either bought himself out or been discharged. And he brought with him a Chinese lady of doubtful age. I would put it at the very kindest at 65, more like 75. And these two announced when they arrived that they wanted to get married. And everyone was quite surprised at this, but it was all duly arranged, and the Commissioner of Customs lent his boat where the wedding took place. And after this happened, it transpired that the lady was in fact the madam of a brothel in Hong Kong, and her idea was to get British nationality by marrying this young Brit, and to set up outside Sandakan a series of caravans which would be brothels, and the young ladies would either be local or brought in from Hong Kong. And of course, needless to say, when after a week or two, the government got wind of this, they were both very smartly extradited, and we never saw them again. So that was another one. But there was a third chap in St. Aken who was an American, a very tall, distinguished-looking man with a completely bald head. And we were absolutely convinced that he was involved in gun running between Indonesia and Borneo. And he was known locally, jocularly, as the Egg for George. I don't know whether you've ever read Agnes Keith's book, Three Came Home, which is about Borneo. Well, she actually, although she's an American, she lived in St. Aken. Her husband was the Commissioner of Forestry there, Scott. And she had written a lot of nasty things about Borneo Europeans, for which they took their revenge after the war. And she was always talking about, while she was in prison camp, having to get an egg for George. Well, this big chap having this bald head was known as the Egg. And he was undoubtedly in the gun-running business with a gentleman with the lovely name of Wee Tin Po, a local Chinese. And I saw him at one stage in Labuan when he was visiting the director of Marine. And after he had visited him, the director discovered that he had lost his watch. And when he went out, he duly found it in this gentleman's pocket. So these were the sort of people that one came across in these places. We had various others. While I'm thinking about that, I've come to mind that we did have an air service in Borneo latterly, which was run by Malayan Airways. But this, in the old days before that, there was an RAF Sunderland flying boat that used to come round, I think, once a month and brought the mail and possibly passengers. But I was actually in Borneo when the first of our services came to as far as Labuan. It came through Kuching and then to Labuan. And our agents were desperately keen to get this business, but rightly or wrongly, Malayan Airways decided they would employ their own staff. And our agents did every trick in the book to try and make the service go wrong in the hope that they would get the business and manage it properly. However, they didn't succeed. The Malayan Airways carried on with their own people. The other thing which comes very much to mind was, whilst I was in St. Aken, I was asked by my people in Singapore if I would find out whether there was any chance of drumming up the old trade which existed between the island of Jolo in the southern Philippines and St. Aken. Now, pre-war, our ships had gone to Jolo, which is part of the Sulu province, and they had brought back trochus shells, which I don't know for what purpose these were used, but they were very popular, and they were transshipped at St. Aken onto our ships, which then took them on to Singapore. And I went to see if this business could be renewed after the war. And the other trade that was there was sawn timber, and I think to some extent copra. I went across, and the ship was manned by a Malay captain and Malay deck officers and Chinese engineers. I was the only European. The ship, called the Sarudum, was of the sort of scrubbing brush type, as we called it. It was one of the ships originally built for the invasion of Normandy, but never used in that capacity. And it did have all the appearance of a scrubbing brush. It was just long with a little sort of part at the aftercastle. And they had virtually no sleeping accommodation for passengers. However, just before I was leaving St. Aken to go on this adventure, the chief of police of St. Aken came down to see me and asked me if I would mind very much if he put aboard 40 pirates who had been captured because at that stage there was piracy going on right around the Borneo coast, and nearly all from the Philippines, and they were almost all of the Moro nationality, who are Muslim. And they had been caught illegally fishing, using explosives and doing other things all around the coast. They had rounded them up, and they were sending them back on our ship to Jolo to go to jail. And so he said, would I mind very much if these chaps were put aboard? And I said, well, no, I didn't think there was any great problem as long as they were all locked up. Oh, he said, I'm sorry, we can't do that. They'll just be put aboard as passengers, asleep on the deck. And so the ship was just about to sail. These men came aboard, and they are extremely fierce-looking individuals. And that evening, as we sailed, I was sitting up on the poop, all on my own, and the Chinese Chinchu, who is the comprador of the ship, came up and asked me what I wanted to eat, and I told him anything that was going, and he duly did that. And I was sitting there eating the fish, whatever it was he produced, when suddenly one of these pirates came up the stairway, and he stood opposite me when I was sitting, and he said, he spoke reasonably good English, and he said, we want some cigarettes. And I had in front of me a tin of 50 Players number 3s, as you probably remember. And I thought, well, now this is a very tricky situation, because if I don't give him any, I could be over the side, and there's no way anybody could stop him. So, and he did have with him a knife. So I thought about this. Fortunately, I'd been fortified by a couple of whiskies before this, which perhaps gave me more courage than I would normally have. And I said to him, now look here, there are 40 of you down there. I only have 20 cigarettes in that tin. The lid was on the tin, I may say. If I give you 20 cigarettes, there's going to be trouble, because not everyone is going to have one. And I think that would be unfair, and I'm sure you would appreciate my feelings in this matter. And there appeared to be a 5-minute interval. It was probably only a matter of seconds. But he glared at me very hard, and I thought, well, this is where Simpson goes over the side and is never heard of again. He smiled slowly, showing me a lot of gold teeth, and said, very well, I agree. And he went down below, and I had no further problems. But I must admit, it was a tricky moment. When we got to Jolo the following morning, it was completely desolated. You could see that the Japanese had razed the place completely, and there was whatever they had damaged had been left there, still damaged, and this was in 1949. And there was a great black Negro leaning up against a bollard, wearing a jersey which said Notre Dame on the front of it, and smoking a big cigar, and that was about the only person visible. We tied up, and in due course, the governor of Sulu came down wearing a hat, which was rather like an upturned soup bowl with a sort of chain round it. And the idea was that he would take command of these pirates and put them away for some considerable period. The pirates went ashore, the governor spoke to them, and then they all dispersed, and they were allowed to go free. And that evening, that afternoon, I went ashore and spoke to the various shops and people involved in the business that there used to be, Turkish shells and timber, found out that the timber business had died off quite a bit, but that American ships were coming in direct to pick the Turkish shells and take them to the States. So there was no way we could resuscitate the old business. In the evening, the Malay captain suggested to me that I shouldn't go ashore, as he said that it was a very dangerous place. There was hardly any street lighting or any other sort of form of civilization. But I felt restless, went ashore, took a torch with me, and went to a cinema where they were showing a thing about the invasion of the Philippines before the war by Moros. And I remember Andrea Leeds was in it, and I can't remember who else. But when I got in, I found that nobody was sitting on the chairs. They were standing on all these rattan chairs. And I thought, this is very strange. Anyway, I couldn't see the film. So I was forced to stand on the chair myself. And I soon found out why. The place was absolutely riddled with rats, and they were running around the floor the whole time. So I quite enjoyed the film, standing up on the top of this chair. Coming back from the cinema, back to the ship, it was a fair walk. There were a few bad-looking characters around the place, but I wasn't actually interfered with in any way. I had the torch, and I got back aboard. When we sailed the following morning, the captain informed me that there had been three people murdered in the little town that previous night. However, it was an experience which I found very interesting.
You were talking about how business had tailed off for one reason or another, the timber business, the shell business.
Yes.
I think there was a new business developed between Sarawak and southern Philippines in later years, which was very, very prosperous and thoroughly illegal. It was the smuggling of cigarettes.
Oh, yes. Yes, that did exist. That is right.
It was a very big trade.
Yes, it was a big trade. Yes. Oh, smuggling was going on all over the place. And in fact, there was a certain element of what you might call official smuggling. This happened in Tawau, which was right down on the very eastern extremity of British North Borneo. And the place below Tawau, its name escapes me, belonged to Indonesian Borneo, originally Dutch Borneo. And at some stage, they swapped over, because it meant the border was all twisted. The British place was the south of the border, and the Dutch was north, so they swapped over. So Tawau, which was originally Dutch, and then Indonesian, became British, just to straighten up the borderline. While I was in Tawau, with our bigger ships, the Straits Steamship vessels, you could see these vessels called Kumpits, which were sailing ships. And they had come in from across the Indonesian border, and they were carrying enormous quantities of copra, which we took immediately out of the Kumpits and put in our ship, took them off to Singapore, transshipped for Europe, and so on. And this was all quite illegal trade. It was barter trade. But the Indonesian gunboats used to come up from Tawau every so often, and they must have had some sort of jungle telegraph, because before the Indonesian gunboats appeared over the horizon, the Kumpits vanished up all these little creeks, disappeared. And it was beautifully organized, but we didn't mind. I mean, the British government of North Borneo didn't mind, because you know, they were getting the trade. But it was actually, I suppose, smuggled out of Indonesia.
Yes, yeah. What about any other colorful characters that you'd like to reminisce about?
Well, in Penang, there was a great chap called Jock Reed, who was commonly known as Jock the Reed. And he was a marvellous man who was a very efficient accountant, had his own business there, and had been a great footballer in his day as well. Had a super Welsh wife, and she, poor lady, died in her middle age, Jock was absolutely distraught, but he had been quite a lad in his day. His wife was alive, he used to go out to the local cabarets and so on, and he used to come home late at night and find that the door was locked and barricaded, and all the furniture was barricaded up against it. So he just used to go away again and back to where he came from. But he was a very, very a very generous person, because at the later stage of his life, and he lived till he was about 80, there was another character, a lawyer, originally from some Central European country, but ostensibly British. And this chap, to everyone's surprise, got married, because nobody thought he was the marrying kind. And he married a very nice nursing sister from across the way in Sungai Petani. They then produced three children. They had twins and another girl, and everyone was very delighted with this sort of thing. However, the lawyer I'm referring to, who married this girl, at some later stage, had run into difficulties. He was quite notorious for getting drunk, and also for setting fire to trishaws and things by whacking the lamp and the trishaw with his blackthorn walking stick and so on. Fairly outrageous character. He went bankrupt, didn't tell anybody, didn't pay his staff in his legal office for 2 months, and then just vanished and pushed off and left his wife and young children. And Jock Reed paid this girl's passage home with her children and all the rest. Never admitted to doing it, but we all knew that Jock did it. That was the sort of man he was. A great, generous character, and one, the sort of Scot that was extremely likeable, and the kind that you don't see many of today. I think that's... Oh, the one other thing which might be of interest on that score, you were talking about not only characters, but incidents. In Sarawak, in the Sarawak Club, which is a very old club, dates back to the Brooke, Raja Brooke days, they had an extraordinary sort of skittle alley there, which had a runway, a wooden runway, which was raised up on either side from the floor. But it seemed to be full of knots and warps. And so when the balls were thrown down, they sort of meandered round in all directions and somehow got to the other end. And the balls were all of different sizes, some enormous things about 2-3 feet across, and other ones about 6 inches and so on, and nobody seemed to care which ball was thrown at any particular time. But this, strangely enough, this skittle alley was built by a man called Francis Drake, who was a member of the Brooke government, one of Brooke's own men, and he was a direct descendant of Sir Francis Drake,
yeah.
Which I thought was rather a nice touch.
Mm. What about dangerous incidents? You've talked about your experience in Singapore when, in the days when Lee Kuan Yew was still a firebrand.
Yes.
Were there any other periods similar incidents?
Yes, there were. The Bertha Hertog riots, which I mentioned alluded to earlier, took place in 1950, and this was when a girl who had been the daughter of a Dutch couple was left behind in Indonesia, or the Dutch East Indies as it was then when the Japanese came. And she was left behind by her parents for some reason. Perhaps they were put in camp or something, and she was left somewhere with an Indonesian armor. And as time went on, the war was over, nobody contacted this Indonesian armor, and this girl was brought up in every respect as a Malay or as an Indonesian. So she became a Muslim, and she spoke basically Malay, Indonesian, rather than Dutch. And that was that. And then when she was about 12 years of age, the foster mother decided that the girl ought to get married, and it's quite common for Muslim girls to marry at 12 or over that. And so she was duly engaged to a Malay man, some considerable years older than herself, and this news obviously got to the original mother, who suddenly appeared in Holland, and then this original mother said she wanted her child back. And unfortunately, all this took place, or the altercation about it, all took place in Singapore, for reasons that I can't remember, and not in Indonesia. And so the case came up there and was being heard in the Supreme Court in Singapore. And word quickly spread of what was happening, and that the possibility was that the girl would be returned to her own mother, the Dutch lady, and taken away from her Muslim foster mother and from her fiancé. And the news spread like wildfire. I remember one afternoon I was sitting in the office, and you heard this yells and screams coming all over Singapore. The Malays who were there, and many of the Indians were also Muslim, had got wind of this, and they had surrounded the Supreme Court, and they started to riot, and they really went mad. They went to town about it. I was actually leaving the office at that time, going down to my Blue Funnel ship to visit it, and discuss with the master what had to be done the following day. And I was down there when he had been listening to the local radio, and he said to me, "I think you'd better get back." It was then dark. And I said, what do you mean? He said, "I think you'd better get back home because the riots apparently are very serious throughout the whole of Singapore, just spread." And I said, "Well, I'm not too worried about that." However, in due course, I got into the car. I had a Malay driver who was a super chap. And we drove up through some very nasty sites of Malays and Indians and various people waving iron bars at us and so on. Got back to the mess, and I had already arranged to take out a young lady from the Red Cross who I had known in my army days in Egypt. And she turned up in Singapore, and she lived a bit away from me, and we had already arranged that we were going out to dinner that night. So when I got back, my mess mates were all there, and they said, "Oh, we're not going out." And I said, "Well, I promised to take this girl out, and I'm going to do it." So I at that stage, I was a non-driver, and I said to my Malay Sais driver, "You'll take us out, Muhammad?" And he said, "Yes, sure." And I said, "Well, now you realize that there's these awful riots going on, and then basically Malays fighting the Europeans." He said, "Yes, I know that, sir," but he said, I don't mind." So we went round to this girl's house, picked her up, and then we went down Orchard Road, which is one of the main roads in Singapore, and it was absolutely strewn with broken glass all the way down the whole road. You could see it in the lights shining like diamonds. And at the roundabout, just outside Government House, there were at least five cars blazing away, set on fire, turned, overturned, and surrounded all round the roundabout with Indians and Malays with iron bars and so on, who had attacked the passengers. And so I think discretion was the better part of valour at that stage. When we got down to there, I said to Muhammad, "Just drive all the way around and come back up Orchard Road, and we'll go back." And this we duly did. How we managed to do it without getting punctured, I have no idea. But we were lucky. We got home, and that I got the girl safely back. But the riots went on, I think, for 4 or 5 days at least. They were very severe, and I've been in riots in Hong Kong and Singapore and Penang, Kuala Lumpur. But these were by far the worst. And we were, those of us who were looking after ships like myself, were given special passes. And we were told to go to work every day. So we went down to our ships twice a day, all through all this sort of stuff, and came back again completely unharmed. We were lucky, because there were a lot of Europeans injured, some killed, some were thrown in the canal, and various things like that.
But it was definitely an anti-European.
Oh, it was completely anti-European. Mm. Completely anti-European, because they reckoned that it was a European judge, our British judge, who was favouring the Dutch mother against the Muslims, you know, the usual sort of thing. Mm. And it was really a very unpleasant situation. The other thing which I did mention to you, is slightly digressing, was when I told you about the houses in Borneo all having been razed by the Japanese. It wasn't until much later on in my career that I learned the reason for this, basically, was that during the Japanese occupation of British North Borneo, three United States naval ships, light ships, rather like our motor torpedo boats, came in to Sandakan Bay, Sandakan Harbour. And I'm not quite sure what the purpose of this bot was, although I met the person who commanded these ships at a later stage, ironically enough, when he settled in Borneo. And what happened was he came into the bay with his three ships, waving flags and all the rest. The Japanese thought this was definitely the beginning of the invasion, and they pulled back into the hills in the jungle behind Sandakan. The local people thought similarly. They came down and, with open arms, waved and cheered. The Americans handed out chewing gum and chocolates and all sorts of things, and patted them on the head, and everybody was very happy until an hour or two later the Americans decided that they'd better pull out for reasons best known to themselves. And having done so, the Japanese then came back and took reprisals on all the local people and burnt down every house in the area.